Welcome to Tech Policy Podcast. I'm Ashkan Kazarian. On today's show, we're going to talk about information intermediaries, and we're joined by Tiffany Lee, resident fellow at Yale Law School, who leads their Wikimedia initiative on intermediaries information. She's also a transatlantic digital debates fellow. Tiffany, thank you for being here.
Thanks. It's great to be here.
Tiffany, so what is that initiative that you're leading at Yale Law School?
So I am a resident fellow at Yale Law School's Information Society Project, an organization I know of which you are very well aware.
Yes. Hello to Professor Balkin.
Hi, Professor Balkin. In addition to that, that role, I'm specifically leading a new initiative for the ISP, and it's called the Wikimedia and Yale Law School Initiative on Intermediaries and Information. So this is a new initiative dedicated to studying issues about online intermediaries involving things like free speech, open internet, intermediary liability, and more.
So information intermediaries have been one of the most powerful players when it comes to digital everything, free speech online, trade. They've been these platforms that are open to everyone. Why are they so important, and how would you define them?
So I think generally speaking, an information intermediary is an online intermediary that allows for the free communication or exchange of ideas or information. An intermediary, even more broadly speaking, is a neutral third party that hosts or provides a space or venue for people to post information or exchange information. And that information can include specific content like text or photos or video, but it can also include data, for example, data going over your local ISP.
So before we had, let's say, internet in the same way we have it now, in the way we know it, in the shape we know it, spreading the information was one of the most important things when you wanted to raise awareness of some kind of shift in politics, or, you know, when there was a coup, that sometimes, you know, they take over the airwaves and there is no way of even knowing what's going on in your country. Even very recently, when there was an attempt at coup in Turkey, I believe last year, they tried to take the first thing they target, aside from airports and, you know, those hubs, are airwaves and TV. However, because we have Twitter and we have Facebook and we have all other platforms, it's way harder to suppress this information. So have we seen a shift in the political landscape ever since information intermediaries came to play?
I think we definitely have. Information intermediaries basically, and I don't want to oversell this, but basically are the backbone of what we consider to be the free and open internet. So these intermediaries include Facebook, Twitter, Google, Wikipedia, all of these places where you can go and get information and exchange information freely. And in America, it's not maybe something we think about that often. But when you get to countries in which you have more restrictive governments, where it's hard to get information, especially politically sensitive information, then you find that information intermediaries are incredibly crucial. And I think the problem that we get, though, is that those countries and those governments also are aware of this. And that's why you get the internet crackdowns. That's why you get the shutdown of Wikipedia, shutting down Twitter, slowing certain internet, you know, websites. That's what happens when governments are aware of the power of intermediaries and the ability of people to use them to actually affect social change.
And the importance of this is so obvious that there are a lot of organizations, for example, our partners Access Now, who work on making sure that journalists and political activists in those countries have access to a platform. They have VPNs or some other encrypted devices and tools to reach people outside of a country. So moving on, information intermediaries, they sound very important and crucial for free speech online, and they also, you know, facilitate economy. But there has been a lot of attempts to limit this, their reign, let's say, their dominance. Recently, for example, the Honest Ads Act, and there's some legislation that is trying to, you know, go after websites who post revenge porn or things that are awful. But also, if you start limiting and chipping away one by one, it can be a slippery slope. Or, for example, if you talk about platforms that host content posted by ISIS fighters, is it radical? Yes. But how can you differentiate between something that is radical and something that is reporting from, a war zone?
It's a very difficult question. And this issue of whether and how to regulate information intermediaries has been, you know, an important issue, I think, ever since intermediaries came into existence, really. So I think there are a few things we have to consider. Now, first of all, we do want to make sure that internet users are kept safe. And I think technology companies right now put a lot of emphasis on making sure their community members are safe. You'll see a lot of policies, and I've worked on some of these policies with different organizations. You'll see privacy policies, you'll see trust and safety policies. There'll be thousands of moderators for some of these larger sites, all dedicated to keeping people safe online. Now, of course, there are going to be bad actors. Like, there always are bad actors in really any area of the world, right? And I think that the key, though, for any regulation or any new legislation is to make sure that we don't overburden intermediaries in trying to reach some sort of maybe unattainable goal. And what I mean by that is it may be impossible to really create a perfect speech environment. I don't think that we want a world in which only a few people are allowed to, for example, allowed to tweet. We also don't want the opposite of that, which is a world in which we just have a million horrible Twitter bots all the time tweeting at each other constantly. What we want is a free speech environment in which people can post what they want and be able to read news that may not be something that a government decides should be posted online, for example. So generally, when you consider the idea of one entity deciding what speech should be online, I think it's a little risky when we start moving in that direction with legislation.
So, and we also see that some platforms are already addressing this, you know, concerns themselves, self-regulating in a way. So Twitter is working on ways to address the Russian bots problem. And Facebook recently unveiled major changes to its newsfeed, you know, its main feature. One of them is that now they're going to turn to the community to rank a credibility of news sources. And the other one is that now they're going to prioritize content from our friends on Facebook and, you know, friends of our friends over the ads. What do you think about the self-regulating attempts?
I think generally these attempts are a net positive. I think it's important that these tech companies realize that they have a responsibility not only to their users, but to the greater global community. I think we've seen, at least in recent years, that social media and intermediaries in general are a force for or against democracy. For example, I think one intermediary that you've seen play a great part in supporting democracy worldwide is Wikipedia. And Wikipedia is an intermediary in the sense that anyone can post or edit on Wikipedia and anyone can read it. This is an intermediary that allows people all over the world to access knowledge. And that knowledge allows them to do things like participate in their own political process or realize the truth of different things happening worldwide. Now, is every intermediary going to be able to self-regulate in the way that, for example, the Wikipedia community can? That's a slightly different question. So what Facebook is doing right now in terms of creating a way for people to report whether something is newsworthy, something is reliable, that's actually really interesting to me because it's similar to what happens in the Wikipedia community. On Wikipedia, people also discuss whether a certain news source is a reliable news source or whether something is quote-unquote fake news. Facebook doing something similar, I think, is quite interesting because the scale of posts on Facebook is so much greater than the scale of posts on Wikipedia, and the community is so much larger. What works for Wikipedia may or may not work for Facebook, but I think it's a positive step in the right direction that Facebook is trying to think about these issues, that they're really taking into account what people have been saying for years and years now about figuring out a way to make sure that we have good speech online, but that we don't have all the negative things that sometimes come with, you know, open internet, for example, harassment, trolls, and so on.
I just realized as you were talking about this that back in law school, when I was writing a paper for Professor Balkin on AI intellectual property, something that I found and was part of my research was your workshop paper on the same topic.
Oh, great.
I completely forgot about this, and it just came back to me as you were talking about algorithms. So, Tiffany, do you mind, for our little segment called Women in Tech, talk a little bit about your career path and what led you to Yale Law School and, you know, led me to encounter your papers online?
Sure. And I think we first have to preface that we are both affiliated, or formerly affiliated in your case, with Yale's Information Society Project, which is an intellectual center at Yale Law School of interdisciplinary scholars dedicated to studying really fascinating issues involving technology, especially technology, law, and policy. So, you know.
Yes. Hello to everyone back there. Keep fighting the good fight, writing the papers, getting those great lunches.
The lunches are the really important part.
Arepas, which happen once every 4 weeks, I believe, were my favorite.
Those are actually my favorite as well. I love those.
Yeah, I think you guys should do more of that. If anyone ever wanted my input on ISP, the only critique is do arepas every other week.
As an alumna, your feedback is quite important. Thank you very much. So I guess talking about my career and not about arepas. I started law school thinking that I was going to be an international legal scholar. I had always done international work, even during college. I'd studied abroad and so on. But when I got into law school, I realized that, well, first of all, international law doesn't really exist.
And that was a shocker, too. Actually, that was how I got into law school, thinking I'm going to do international human rights and, you know, just like international law in general, like international IP law. That was my passion. And then I was like, oh, it's not enforceable.
Exactly. Right. So I think a lot of people came into law school with those ideas. And you realize international law is a very complicated subject, et cetera, but also that pretty much any area of law is global in nature nowadays. And then especially technology is very global because you cannot put borders on the internet, no matter how hard certain countries try to.
King I choose Russia. So as we were recording and we said hello to the Russian intelligence officers, our recording device shut down. Now we're back up with Tiffany, who was sharing with us her career path and how she realized that international law is not, you know, existent in some ways. Sorry, Professor Halfway. but it's also, you know, the tech part of it is very global, you said, right?
Right, definitely. So technology is global in nature. And I think during my first year of law school, I realized that I've always been passionate about technology in some ways. I love science fiction since childhood. When I was 10 years old, I subscribed to Asimov's Science Fiction magazine, which I think is one of the nerdiest facts about me. So this love of science fiction and thinking about the future was something that I didn't realize could be part of my legal career until I got into law school. And in my first year of law school, I started talking to other attorneys who had done work in this area. And I realized that being a tech lawyer, you could really work on issues that weren't even really set in stone yet. So instead of just negotiating contracts every day or trying to figure out the best litigation strategy for something, you could work specifically on issues that were really exciting to me because they weren't determined. So I'm sure you know this as well, but so many technology law issues, technology law and policy issues, are just completely up in the air, changing every day, constantly being renewed and rebooted. And that to me was something fascinating. So during law school, I decided I wanted to do technology law. What technology law was a good question. And that's something that I had to find out through really talking to a lot of people. I think my best advice for law students or people who are just starting out in this field is to talk to as many people as you possibly can. Talk to people, especially people who have done things that you think are interesting that you would want to do, and then ask them how they got there. For example, I talked to many older attorneys who had worked in tech or who were at tech companies or in tech organizations and asked how they became experts and leaders in their field. And I think what really I learned was that you just have to follow your passions. So for me, I realized that my passion was technology. Really, my passion was science fiction, but tech law is the closest thing.
The closest thing, yeah.
It's close enough. So I pursued that passion. I took as many courses as I could that were related to technology and the internet. And I also interned at various tech-related places during law school. And then after law school, I was a privacy fellow at the Wikimedia Foundation, where I had also interned during law school. So love the Wikimedia Foundation. They are the nonprofit that runs Wikipedia and other free knowledge projects. And after that fellowship, I worked as in-house counsel for a technology education company based in New York called General Assembly. They do education, coding, UX design, that kind of thing. So being an in-house counsel, I think, is really great. And it's something that I enjoyed quite a lot. I think the best part of it for anyone thinking about in-house career, the best part about being an in-house counsel is really working with non-lawyers. When I talk to new grads and law students who are thinking about in-house careers, I always put it this way. If you, especially in technology, you run into two scenarios. Either you get that sort of one-man shop that you discussed, right, where you have a very small legal team and they have to do absolutely everything. That involves contracts, litigation, real estate, employment law. If you're an internet company, you have the terms of service, you have the privacy policies, you have trust and safety. All of that is done by a very small team where everyone has to be a team player and do really any area of law they can. That's one scenario. The other scenario is you get into one of those very large companies. For example, if you're an in-house attorney at Google, you will not be doing everything. You will be doing, for example, strictly only open source licensing. And that's when you get into a large enough company where they have, you know, tons of attorneys and every attorney has a very specific role. Now, if you are a new grad or you are an attorney with only a few years of experience and you're trying to get into the tech sector, I think that the best decision or the best choice would be to try to get into a small or mid-sized company. And I'm saying this because if you apply directly, for example, to Google with no tech experience, it's very unlikely that you'll get hired. If you are at a firm where you've done a lot of tech work, for example, if you did 3 years straight of only tech transactions focusing on internet companies, then you have a much better chance. But if you don't have that background, I would recommend seeking out tech companies that may be slightly smaller that will require you, though, to have many skills and to be able to pick things up very quickly.
And another way to do this is also go work for an NGO. If you're very passionate about policies and not as passionate about getting paid, that's always a way to do, you know, good in the world. Or go work on the Hill. The Hill is in awful need of smart, young, passionate lawyers who understand technology beyond knowing how to send an email and are passionate about technology and are optimistic about the future and want to change it for the better. I'm going to do a plug-in for Tech Congress, which is a great program that brings in actually people who specialize more in the tech side and not the policy side of things, and brings them into congressional offices, places them there for a year to help the staffers with the technology part of tech policy.
That sounds like a great program. When I was in law school, one of my favorite internships was a policy internship that I did at Amazon's DC office. And I think just being part of that office and seeing how people actually worked was fascinating to me. Seeing the policy process, especially internet issues, firsthand was invaluable. So if you are in DC or if your law school or public policy school allows you to take a semester in DC, I would highly recommend trying to get a job either on the Hill or with a policy shop, just something where you can learn about how the legislative process actually works. A few other internships I did during law school that were helpful were for government agencies. So I did an internship at the Department of State and one at the FCC. And of course, now working in tech policy, which I mentioned was global, these internships were also, you know, very helpful in retrospect.
Yeah, absolutely. And also Tiffany and I are both fellows at the Foundry, which is this great network of young professionals. And we actually have a lot of even third-year law students who are part of a foundry too, who are interested in these issues and think and write about them. It's, you know, finding networks like that and connecting with people and asking them questions is how you end up working in the field that you're passionate about. Wouldn't you say so?
Definitely. So the Internet Law and Policy Foundry is what you just mentioned, the foundry. And I think that is a great group of emerging leaders in technology policy. So we have tech lawyers, we have people in tech policy, we have people who are more on the academic or NGO side. But I think what really connects everyone there, and I'm sure you'd agree, is just everyone is very passionate about technology. These are just huge nerds. Like, really, these are people who just love tech, love talking tech, and have dedicated their careers to tech. So it's a great group.
Our happy hours are notoriously nerdy. It's amazing. Honestly, I think joining, as you were talking about your passion for science fiction, joining the tech law and tech policy kind of area is the best way you can use as many puns as you want and as many, you know, references to Star Wars or Star Trek. I mean, you pick your own as you want. That's at least my goal in life.
So would you be Star Wars or Star Trek?
Growing up in Russia, I never knew that there was, you know, two camps.
Okay.
So I grew up watching Star Trek with my dad. However, as I got more into teenage years, I got more passionate about Star Wars. And it seems like as of right now, Star Wars is still producing good content, whereas Star Trek has been more in the backseat of a retro thing.
Well, there's a new show. There's a new Star Trek show. It's on some channel that's, I think, streaming only, though, and you have to pay for a subscription. So I have not watched that
show. Barriers to opportunity, everyone. Barriers to opportunity.
Yeah, we need a free and open internet so we can all watch Star Trek.
On that note, Tiffany, thank you so much for joining us. It was a pleasure, and we hope you'll come back when you want to talk anytime about any of the amazing and fascinating projects you're working on.
Of course, and of course, you are always welcome back at Yale ISP whenever you want.
I'm coming for the arepas. Follow us on Facebook and Twitter at Tech Freedom, and leave us a review so others can find the show. Thank you for listening.
The Tech Policy Podcast is produced and distributed by Tech Freedom, a nonpartisan, nonprofit think tank in Washington, D.C. To learn more about our work, make a tax-deductible donation, or find other episodes, find us online at techfreedom.org.